Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're going book collecting. As you know, we're big advocates of the printed page here at Monocle, and we're certainly not alone. All around the world, bibliophiles are hunting down first editions, signed copies and limited runs of their favourite books. They might be in a glass cabinet in a museum, sitting in storage awaiting auction, or hidden at the back of dusty shelves in small, unassuming bookshops. In some cases, rare books can sell for millions, and so while the story on the page might be valuable enough for most readers, for others, the object itself is far more so.
People love Shakespeare, so they want to see the first time that Shakespeare was printed. I've seen people hold this and weep.
So join us as we go hunting with experts, archivists, curators, collectors, and booksellers in all corners of the world on Culture with me, Robert Bound. We'll start in Hong Kong. Finding a rare bookshop in Asia can be trickier than tracking down a first edition folio. Our Hong Kong correspondent, James Chambers, pays a visit to Lok Man Rare Books and sits down with its erudite founder, Lawrence Johnston.
Nearly all of our customers are based in Asia, and I would say a majority are in Hong Kong. We don't sell on the internet. In fact, we will usually discourage someone from buying from us if we haven't met them or they haven't been introduced to us. And then we have people that fly in who either used to work here or come here for business meetings and will come to see us when they get a chance. Or I'll go and visit them like a doctor. I go to the offices and I visit.
With a suitcase full of books? Or
I will visit customers in Hong Kong with this big Gladstone bag, I suppose it looks like. My big leather bag, yes, I'll do that. But overseas, no. I'll buy and then I'll ship. But it's nice. I walk past people waiting in line to visit, you know, the Mandarin of some financial group, and I might spend 2 hours with them, much to the frustration of everyone else, as we put the books out on the boardroom table, and they like that idea of a private book dealer.
Are you the classiest door-to-door book salesman in the world? Are you taking?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, but no dictionaries.
Most of your books here appear to be from the West, from Europe.
Yep.
Do you collect any Eastern literature, or are you planning to, or is that just not what the business offers?
It's a matter of knowledge. It's a matter of knowledge. And academia, too. I have access to bibliographies and into specialists in different areas if I need it to verify that a book published in the 1600s is what it says it is. Is it the first edition? How many copies were printed? I have to paginate and make sure that everything is in order. To get that, I need to have access to records written about that book. So, for example, Oliver Twist there, I can pretty much tell you which day that first edition set of three volumes of Oliver Twist were published on. It's about the 10th day of publication, because they changed letters and words and bits fell off the printing press and you go through it all. But that's because it's been written up and read through over a century. And that's all documented. With works in Chinese, for example, there's very little research that's been done, or even collectors who've written about their collections, in order for me to verify that what comes through my door is exactly what I'm then describing it and sell it. And so without that, then I can't deal in that area. There's not enough knowledge about it.
Out of all the books, all the lovely books you have here, which one is your favorite?
My favorite at the moment. You know, this is Hong Kong, so normally that's not the question I get asked. Normally the question I get asked is, which is the most expensive book?
You can also answer that too if you
no,
want.
No, I'm not. No, I like your question is much better. And it's one of the things we have to fight through here. Like, is a book an investment? No, not financially. So at the moment, Harry's cocktail book, Barflies and Cocktails. There you are. By Harry Wynn. I love this little book. There we go. 1927. So Harry started this bar in Paris, which became Harry's Bar. 1920s. Hemingway, all the rest of them, and wrote this little cocktail book, a little small cocktail book with fantastic illustrations. And it's dedicated to the Barfly Club. And there's even little songs for the Barfly Club in here as well, and pictures of the club. And it's such a rare little creature. So that's one. And then the other current favorite is this, and I have to get my glasses because I have to get it right. There we go. So this is Jane Collier, 1757. An essay on the art of ingeniously tormenting. That's brilliant. It's basically the opposite of how to win friends and influence people. It's how to annoy everybody and how to make people feel small and insignificant and uncomfortable. And she goes through everything, how to make your husband feel uncomfortable, servants, friends. It's just brilliant.
How do you go about selling it? I know you don't want to, because I've never heard of it. I'd love to have owned the Barflies one, but I didn't know it existed.
Yeah.
You know, is it a case of when people come in, they ask you advice and then you steer them in that direction? Or do you, any kind of marketing involved, will you try and push certain books?
We do a lot of work in that area. So, for example, a book on tormenting. I have a customer in New Zealand who collects works like that, also on food, but works that are just quirky and sharp. And this is now reserved for her because I had her in mind. I thought she'd find this fascinating, and she doesn't have it. So that's the marketing side. I mean, is the knowledge of your customers. That's why we don't sell on the internet, because then I can't get to know people and what they like. So the cocktail book, yeah, we'll have a cocktail evening here, or for the marketing, there will be a magazine that will want to feature it as, you know, the perfect gift to give to your husband if he likes cocktails. Or I have another customer who has a nice apartment in one of those buildings on the river in Paris, you know, the little bridges, one of those buildings there, Harry's. I have to be creative and think along those lines. I can't just pump it out with advertisements. Yeah. That's where it gets interesting. Sometimes I'll just buy a book because I like it, and usually that's the easiest one to market or promote. It's the hardest one to sell because I don't really want to sell any of my books.
Toronto is home to the Thomas Fisher Rare Book Library, the largest publicly accessible rare books and manuscripts collection in Canada. Pierce Carefoot is the interim head of rare books and special collections, medieval manuscripts and early books. We've sent Monocle's Will Kitchens to the library to meet with Pierce to find how you spot a rare book.
A book might be rare because it was created to be rare. So, for example, if a book was printed in a limited run, say, of 100 copies, that was intended to be rare, and so we will try to get it, especially if it's a Canadian limited edition of that sort. Other books are rare because they are unique. So manuscript material, medieval manuscripts, for example, they're automatically rare because they're one-offs. They're the only copy that was done. Books can become rare with time. So, for example, a book that was printed, say, in the 17th century that had a print run of maybe 1,200 copies, and we are now down to fewer than 40 left in the world. Although it did not start out life as rare, it's become both rare and scarce, and so it ends up in the collections. Also, association copies. So that means that you might have just a regular book, a legal text, for example, that someone used when they were going through school. There still could be thousands of copies of it. But if it was Benjamin Disraeli's copy and it has his notes in it, or if it was Sir John A. Macdonald's copy and it has his notes in it, it becomes rare because of its association. As I say, it's a moving target, but it gives us at least something to work with when someone comes to us and says, would you like my books?
And what was the process of often, I mean, I imagine it varies wildly and depends on the individual book and text, but what is the process of typically finding these like?
We find our rare books because very often donors will come to us and want to give us their books. That's one of the ways in which this happens. The other way it happens is because we have built up relationships with dealers all around the world. And they know the kinds of books that we want to add to the collections. And so they will contact us and they'll say, you know, we know you're interested in early Reformation materials. I have some pamphlets that were written by Luther. Is that something like you would like to have? Yes, it is. They know that we're interested because we have a strong collection of anatomy and medical texts. They will come to us with, say, you know, we have this rare book from the 15th century. Is this something you would like? And then we'll proceed to see if we can obtain it. So it's very much about those relationships with dealers, antiquarian book dealers all around the world, and keeping, maintaining good relationships with them.
Do you typically do quite a bit of research about what you think or what you know the text is beforehand, before you purchase something? Or is it something that sometimes you're like, we need to pounce on this, and then you kind of dive deep into research afterwards?
You absolutely have to pounce. The world of antiquarian book dealers has changed. In the old days, it used to be they would issue printed catalogs, and the idea of the gentleman librarian who sat at his desk and did nothing but read all day, from that then would send a letter off to the dealer in London or in Vienna and ask for this book. That's gone. They still issue the printed catalogs, but they issue principally electronically. And that means that you've got to act very, very quickly, or else someone else will, and they do. It's not at all unusual for a catalog to be issued on Monday morning, and by the time you have a chance to get around to looking at it, and it's Monday noon, the book is gone. So, very different world.
And in your opinion, what are some of the highlights in the collection here?
We are the only library in Canada that has the first folio of Shakespeare. So the collected works of Shakespeare was printed in 1623. We also have the other three folios of the 17th century. So the four folios are the principal collection of Shakespeare's collected works, and we're the only library that has that in Canada. This is the first folio. And as I say, this was printed in 1623, and it's important for several reasons, but the most important reason was because of the plays in here, about half of them we would not know if it were not for this book, because there's no existing copy of previous publication. So, for example, Macbeth and Julius Caesar, for example, are two of the ones that we would not know if it weren't for the 1623 printing. So it's extremely important in terms of English literary history, and it's iconic value. I mean, people love Shakespeare, so they want to see the first time that Shakespeare was printed. It just, I've seen people hold this and weep, you know, which I think is a little excessive, but still, I kind of get it. So this would have been about £1 in 1623, which was still a reasonable amount of money. But I think one of the last times it sold, it went for a little over $6 million American dollars.
Personally, are you a collector of books or a collector of other things, or is this something you keep at work?
The only library that I keep at home is a professional library, so the one that I use to be able to do my work. I have very few quote-unquote rare books in my own collections at home. No, I actually collect Canadian art, so it's an entirely different thing. I've come to understand how important collectors are to be able to do the work that we do here. If we didn't have people that had a passion for the collections, for their own collections, we would not have this library, because more than half of our library, most likely it's far more than half, is a result of people who had a passion for books and collected them. So although it is not my particular collecting habit, it's certainly one that I value.
With that knowledge under our belts, it's time to hit the shops again. Secondhand bookstores come in all shapes and sizes, but few can compare to the scale of the Collector's Treasury, which is set across 8 floors in downtown Johannesburg, South Africa. With an estimated 2 million books, from cheap paperbacks to rare antiquities, the family-run business is believed to be the largest of its kind in the Southern Hemisphere. And as Monocle reporter Gavin Fisher has been finding out, it's not just its size which makes visiting the shop a unique experience.
You'd be forgiven for believing, on first entering the Collector's Treasury, that you were in a storage space, not a bookshop. The piles of books to navigate past on the entrance stairs are just the first glimpse of what awaits you.
Right, hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, is it Jeff?
I can give you my divided attention.
Jeff Class is one of two brothers who founded the store in 1974.
At the moment, we are even more chaotic than usual because we've had large influxes of material.
Standing in the shadow of a pile of books which is shoulder high, Jeff projects a dishevelled, scattered passion that seems to embody the ethos of the stall.
We've probably developed concepts of chaos that are not recorded anywhere else. We started out very neat. Hell is paved with good intentions. So
so most of the books are on this level, you say?
No. Follow the guide, sir.
The shop has 8 floors, though only 4 are filled with books. All are ready to burst with the scale of their stock, but on close inspection, some order is evidenced by shelf labels showing the usual categories like fiction, history and politics, and even rooms dedicated to interesting specialties.
This room is more antiquarian stock, leather-bound things. And this is a nice thing. This is one of the volumes of plates from Diderot's Encyclopedia, the great 18th century work. That is best part of 100,000 rands worth.
That's over $8,000, and there are more like it nearby, giving a small insight into the value of the books the collector's treasury holds. Jeff is the man who does the buying and prides himself on spotting the best ones.
Hey, I've got 45 years worth of experience in the trade. One also learns to look at something and say, I think this is good. And then research takes over.
So where are you going to buy?
So it's deceased estates, people moving house, people giving up collections, people needing money.
Where next? Where should we have a look?
Next, well, I'll take you into what you will probably not recognise as a lift.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, no, it's probably a lift that could fit 20 people and just about two of us going to squeeze around the books,
well,
I think.
There's space at the back.
With 2 million books crammed into every available space, you'd think the collector's treasury would have everything you could want. But Jeff says the availability of local works is hampered by South Africa's past.
African literature is difficult to get because a lot of it was either going to be banned or had been banned. So African literature is always in short supply.
So what are people coming in for?
African history, ancient history, art books, literature, modern first editions. And a little while ago we had an absolutely mint Clockwork Orange, for example, which looked like the day it was printed. And that got snapped up at 100,000 rand.
Yikes.
And they don't have to be old to be valuable.
So with your 40 years experience, do you remember some of your highlights, like the Clockwork Orange coming in?
Yes, I've got at the moment, for example, the first monograph on Leger, the modern abstract artist.
Can we see it?
It's downstairs in a cabinet. So far, so good. There it is.
How do you feel looking at it?
There's a feeling of history. There is a sense that this book has documented an era.
As his eyes sparkle with enthusiasm, something becomes clear to me. Jeff sells books as it's the best way to facilitate his true passion, the buying of books.
When I went buying this morning, and the person said to me, if there are things you don't want to buy, should we pulp them? And I said, no, they have the same, I suppose, significance as tropical forests or whatever you want. They are part of the evolution of the planet.
For all the book enthusiasts who may visit the store, he is this treasury's main collector.
A library in Slovenia holds one of Europe's most unusual literary collections, more than 3,000 miniature books. Each of them measures no more than 10 centimetres in height or width, and it took Martin Znidarschitz 40 years to gather the tiny volumes from more than 50 countries. In 2010, he donated his entire collection to Ljubljana City Library to mark his hometown's year as World Book Capital. Now they're available for any visitor to enjoy, including Monocle's Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay.
Well, naturally, this is a very quiet place, being a branch of Ljubljana City Library. But there's a riot of colour in front of me on this table, a red velvet cloth, and on top of it, dozens upon dozens of miniature books with all sorts of different covers, some obviously religious, some obviously dealing with issues of entertainment. We can see others which have maybe got some fairy tales inside, and the person who can tell us all about this amazing collection is Pablo Fajdiga, who's the curator of this collection of miniature books.
We have here miniature books from different countries. This one is a miniature Quran.
And it's not just an ordinary bound book, it's in a rather interesting case.
It's a metal case with a magnifier here.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And apparently, during the First World War, the British Army gave these Qurans to his Muslim soldiers to take it with them in the battle. That's why it's very interesting, this edition.
We've got a Muslim holy book, we've got a Jewish holy book. I imagine there's probably a miniature Bible, New Testament, around here somewhere.
That's right. the most beautiful editions were produced in East Germany. This is the New Testament. It's readable with the naked eye without problem.
So it is.
The binding is very strong.
So these are leather bound.
That's right.
Are these just curious items to put on your shelf and have as decoration?
Not at all. For example, look at this book. This is a cookery book.
Handbook of Practical Cookery.
And it's been well thumbed by the looks of it.
That's right. Published in England. And apparently it was used daily.
So why would you produce a book like that in miniature, Pablo?
The miniature books were very popular in the 19th century because they were easy to carry with you. That's why you have a lot of Bibles.
So this one is the Book of Common Prayer.
That's right. And it was easy to carry with you and to read it when you like it, no?
I see you want to introduce one more. This is obviously Japanese.
This is a collection of three miniature books. I mean, fairy tales, children fairy tales, apparently very popular in Japan.
So this is something you might actually give as a present to a child. And it's like...
This we call it Liporello.
They're like...
Accordion book.
They're almost like decorative screens. You could imagine these actually being set in the corner of a room. Beautiful full-colour illustrations of these various Japanese fairy tales. I wonder if I know some of them. That almost looks like the story of the rabbit and the badger.
Oh.
So which is one of the more gruesome Japanese fairy tales.
Oh, yeah?
Has to be said. A badger murders farmer's daughter. Rabbit decides to gain revenge on farmer's behalf and drowns the badger. Now, this does look to me... I mean, I'm not sure if that's that's a rabbit. It could be. Long ears.
You're right.
So this is the rabbit drowning the badger in one of these lovely, gruesome Japanese fairy tales.
Exactly.
Now that Dr. Janidasic has donated his collection to the library, he did this 8 years ago when Ljubljana was the world capital of books.
In 2010.
Is that the end of this collection? Does this collection now stand complete, or are you tempted to add to it?
Well, little by little we are adding some books. For example, these 3 minutes, these stories, he didn't know them. I showed to him, and he was very surprised. How ingenious is that miniature books. We also have a lot of people who bring here to the library books which are not interesting for them, and some of them are miniature books. So we are adding that books to this collection. So the collection is little by little increasing.
To finish the show, we're going to meet two brothers whose publication might be of interest to anyone with a passion for print. The Book Collector was started in 1947 by none other than Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. It's a quarterly journal aimed at, well, the clues in the title. There's plenty of facts and figures in these pages, auction sales reports, dealer catalogues and so on, but there's plenty of interesting reading to be had too. Articles could be on anything from publishing in far-flung countries, some of fiction's greatest characters, the binding of a book, or libraries of famous people. It's part practical handbook, part celebration of the book as a piece of art, and altogether a fascinating research tool for the history of the publishing industry. The Book Collector was taken over by Fleming's nephews, James and Fergus Fleming, just over 2 years ago, and they tell producer Holly a little bit more.
The Book Collector was launched by our uncle Ian, the creator of James Bond, and he did it in the same year that he wrote Casino Royale, which is the first of the Bond novels, in order to make available, I think, to a general public the knowledge that he had acquired putting together his own collection of books, which was absolutely unique. He had the idea of collecting books that were the first editions for ideas that have been important to Western civilization. So, the automobile, the bicycle, soccer, birth control, everything. And these first editions would perhaps only be two or three pages, done on very scantily. And so to make a collection of it was a great achievement. And he wanted to make that available, that knowledge available.
The idea of it, people might think it's more for the publishing industry. And I wonder if you know who your audience is, because there's a lot in there for people who are just interested in books or just love reading.
I wouldn't say it was for the publishing industry. so much as more the book collector, which is a very separate market, very separate readership. Much more, I wouldn't say erudite, but recherché.
Yes. And most of the people, they read us for our articles. We cover the book, as it were. To say that we are addressing only book collectors is wrong. We cover the book, the history of... We've had everything from Kenneth Williams' handwriting to articles on Karl Marx's hat to sort of paper used in 16th century Italian publishing. Everything we cover, really. And the features that you mentioned, the catalogues and the sales report, are because the sales report in particular is very interesting, because people who collect books, they may not admit it, but they do like to know what those books are worth, you know, from time to time.
This came back into the family, the
yes.
Fleming estate,
yes.
2.5 years ago, I believe.
Yes.
And you put out an edition last spring that was all about your uncle, Ian, and...
Yes. My brother Fergus was entirely responsible for the success, for the brilliance of it.
It's a really nice way to look at an author. You know, we meet massive fans of his work who've collected all of his books. They want to live the James Bond lifestyle with the cars. There's articles about his bookseller. It's just a nice history of someone that maybe hasn't been told in another way.
It is an extraordinary aspect of Ian, which was, I think, quite unknown to most people. And it's that unusual combination of somebody who's very famous for one thing, in his case, James Bond, also being very adept and very capable in a completely different field, which is really quite unrelated. And I think it's the combination of the two that make it such a success, I think.
And in one of the opening essays, I think it's yours, James, where you say you actually only met Ian a couple of times
yes.
throughout your life.
Yes.
So when you were putting this together, did you learn a lot about your uncle that you didn't know before?
We did it through a position of unique ignorance. yes, I certainly did, because I wrote a piece on Ian Fleming and the book collector, delving into the archives, and it was remarkable seeing him in action. With the people, with his fellow directors of the book collector, who were perhaps, it'd be fair to say, rather drier than himself. And he was a bit more outgoing and adventurous, and it was quite revealing to see how he was trying to turn it very much into an outgoing business, as opposed to an inward-looking and slightly dusty journal. And the letters between him and his fellow directors are really quite amazing. They fought like cats, if that's the right expression. Book collecting of its nature can be dry. There is no escaping a certain dryness to the topic.
Yes.
But I think it's important in producing a periodical like this to ensure that it is as appealing as possible to as many people and not just purely the specialist.
That was James and Fergus Fleming of The Book Collector. Bring us to the end of today's programme. You can subscribe to the publication at thebookcollector.co.uk, where you can also find a full archive of every single journal to date. Before I leave you today, I have some news. Next week will be the final episode of Culture with Robert Bound. But fear not, there will still be plenty of artsy nourishment in the form of a new programme we'll be starting in April called The Monocle Culture Show, which will be the new home of reviews here on Monocle 24 and our live music session. So make sure you join us next week as we bid farewell to Culture in its current format and look forward to a new era of the new programme. This episode was, of course, produced by Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. And thanks, as ever, for tuning in.